This is the beginning of the second tape in our second oral history interview with Min Sussman on July 9th, 1974. Min, you were just telling us about beginning law school and the various influences in your lives, and also the contradictory advice that you received from two young men you knew as you entered law school.
Well, when I started, I think for the first time, I probably was rather retiring. I didn't move in. I usually come on quite strong wherever I go. But I was applying it very carefully, not intentionally, but from uncertainty. I mean, really, I recognized the fact that this was quite an unusual thing for there to be women.
How many women were there in your class?
There were 12, a lot, out of a class of... if you'll turn it off for a second, let me kind of look. I was just checking with Milt about the size of our class. Our class initially was 199. Now, to get into law school at that time, all you did was just to go down and say you want to come.
and you
showed that you were graduated from an accredited college, period. No interviews, no nothing. You had to, however, be apply to your own local county bar because they had to agree to your going to law school.
Before you even went to law school.
Yes, you had to file your application for admission to the bar. So, in the county, at that time, you had two examinations, one before you went to law school and the other upon completion of law school, passing of the boards, and you had to have one then to be admitted to your own county. So, and you had to have a preceptor. My preceptor was Judge James Galbraith.
Was this someone who, what did that mean, someone who sponsored you?
No, you had to serve clerkship in a law office for 6 months. And so it had to be in the office of someone who had been practicing for a minimum of 5 years. I originally had wanted to be in Pittsburgh, but we didn't know any lawyers here. The only one I knew was Gertrude Markle, and she's related to family, Gertrude Friedlander-Mark. She's related to my mother somehow. And although Gertrude had been out the requisite number of years, her practice wasn't such that it would have been meaningful. I did go down and I did speak with her. But then through my parents' closest friends, William Horwitz, I had an interview with Leo Rustland. And I was never so affronted in all my life. He said, when you graduate from college, then come to me. He thought I was just graduating from high school. Just the concept of a woman going,
and I was also very young. You were trying to find your preceptor before you started law school.
Oh, sure, you had to have all that kind of thing. And I was only 19,
and
I was a very young 19, a young looking, and so when I got to be quite friendly with Leo many, many years later, and I reminded him of that and how affronted I was. He refused to believe me.
Do you remember how you reacted?
Oh, I was outraged. I was furious with him for not consenting to taking me as a law clerk. But my mother...
What excuse did he get?
He thought I was too young. When you're ready to go to law school, and he couldn't seem to understand the fact that I was ready to go to law school, I should come back then. He couldn't get it through his mind that I was already being graduated from college. Because I was just about the age when people, a number of them, were just going to college.
And he knew better than you where you were, and well, what you looked like, or thought he did.
So anyhow, I ended up, and I really feel that it was a very good thing to happen. I'm more and more of the belief that out of bad comes good. And sometimes things that seem so despairing and disastrous, really, one grows and develops, and things, much better things come out of it. At least it's been that way in my life.
When you had so much difficulty finding a preceptor, and this was...
I didn't. That was the only way. I didn't. He was the only one.
I was wondering if it had anything to do with your being a woman, or a little girl in his eyes.
I think that was it with Leo. No question about it at that point. But in Butler, my mother had worked in the community with Edith Galbraith, whose father was judge. And mother spoke to Edith. Now Edith had never gone to law school. Edith was an only child, or she had a brother who was in a mental institution. Oh no, and that's right, and she had a sister too. She had a sister who was married to an attorney in Pittsburgh, Bob Avery. Mother spoke with Edith. Edith was running her father's office. Now, Edith had read law, but she had started being a secretary in her father's office. She read law, and she was admitted locally. At that time, you could do so.
You could still do that. You could do that in the 20s.
Yes. Uh-huh. It was only around the 20s, really, that they began having bars of the state boards. Up until that time, it was primarily being admitted just locally. So Edith couldn't practice anywhere but in Butler County. So mother spoke with her, and no question, I just came in as a law clerk. Judge Galbraith had been on the bench, and then when his term was up, he'd been practicing law, and there was Judge Henninger had died, and Judge Galbraith was appointed as an interim judge. And so I was in their office, and I met with the members of the examining committee. They were very pleasant and very nice to me, but I was an oddity to them. And really, I think it's because of Mother and Dad's reputation and their position in primarily my mother, because my father was a businessman, and my mother was the one who was active in the broader community.
Yes.
Dad kept pretty much to the Jewish community. But they had an excellent reputation.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it was because of that. And then I think also some of them thought I was Italian. Minnie Spiro, and I had dark hair, and my skin was a sort of a creamy color. I looked more like a northern Italian.
Well, don't you think they could have been impressed by the fact that you were a college? Yes, they knew you had gone to school there
I don't know, because also the one thing that could have been held against me, and it was, that I was, those that knew I was Jewish, because there had been only one Jew who had been a member of the bar, and that was many, many years before. That was somewhere around 1911 or 1912, and he had been disbarred. And they have long memories in Butler. And this was in 1929, And there had been a couple young Jewish men who had applied and had been turned down. So they never went on to law school because, you see, they don't have to give any reason.
Really? The way could be blocked then, simply by the
way could be blocked, very definitely. They just say you're not qualified. You don't measure up to our standards. And at that time, there wasn't this business. Since it's a close, law was a close corporation, just like doctors, you know, and God forbid that you should sue a doctor, and God forbid that you should question anything on the in the legal profession. It's totally different today,
and
I
really
think much
better. It was a more personal thing to get into law school then.
Oh, very. And if there was any question whatsoever about your family and the status of your family, you weren't accepted.
That's interesting.
There's a couple instances that I can tell you of young men who had completed law school who weren't permitted to practice. They were never accepted into county bars. One here in Allegheny County and one in Lycoming County because the fathers had been indicted and found guilty. And so the sons,
that
the
is
sins,
a change.
The sins of the fathers were definitely visited on the children.
The sins or the supposed sins or the likes or dislikes?
Yes, I mean, so that was the only hurdle, and really I didn't have enough sense at that time to know that was a hurdle. Because a lot of these things, you see, I got afterwards when they started accepting me and becoming very friendly with me. So I went and started law school, and there was Milton.
Was he in your class?
Yes, that's where I really got to know him. There were 199 in our class. 8 of whom were women. 99
you
were
pioneers.
99 were graduated 3 years later. 2 women. Only one of us passed the bars. The other one didn't. And Milton used to keep a check on bar admissions for years, statewide as well as locally. Before I was one of the very few women for a period of about 10 or 12 years.
Can you explain that? I mean, I know you were bright, but I would imagine
I don't know whether they didn't go or didn't pass the bars. Many of them didn't pass the bars. They were in law school, but failed to pass on that.
It would be interesting to know.
That might be an interesting thing for you to research on women in the law and women in medicine.
I know the record was very poor for finishing school, but I didn't realize that even of those
bars.
Who graduated, the
bars were for 2 days, 8 hours a day. And I didn't have enough sense to know that I was doing anything unusual. I mean, I worked and I studied, although Milton contends that I got through the law school by reading the Saturday Evening Post. but as I said, I played it very carefully and did not come on strong. And I waited for them to approach me. I think part of it was law school and part of it, I never had or have been aggressive or men are concerned.
Oh, it was a different situation from high school.
No, I wasn't aggressive where men were concerned there either. No man ever asked me.
But your classes were. The classes in high. This is sort of silly to even compare.
Yeah.
But you were the no doubt outstanding in your high school class that was at least half girls.
Oh yes. Oh yeah. Oh, there was another. You remind me of another thing. You know, I was just thinking about it the other day. And I guess these were family influences and family thinking. It always amazed me, whether in elementary school or in high school or in college, to find out that there were really very bright Christians, too.
I thought only the Jews. You know, the Jews were the smartest. This is the way I was brought up. And that I believed. Because I know in my prophet. And I can say this because this is for the Jewish thing. I have found throughout that the Jewish person, and I don't think I am being chauvinistic, I'm too totally subjective, but whether it has been in school or professional life or my community experiences, that a Jew is much more stimulating to be with, much more, much broader in his interests and scheme of things.
Maybe more willing to talk about many different issues.
Well, I mean, but they're involved. They're involved in social needs, even if they are opposed to them. At least they're aware of them. They're interested in what goes on. They're interested in even the drabbest and the dullest are interested in news. Even the housewife. And I'm not saying that in a pejorative sense, in a condemning sense. But I mean, those who have been perfectly happy to let their lives be just confined to the four walls, even there has been a certain kind of knowledge and an awareness.
At least
I have not found without the others. I mean, take just the housewife. You compare the average non-Jewish housewife, and I'm using housewife now in the narrow sense.
But the woman who stays at home.
The woman who stays home does nothing but the cooking and the cleaning and the rearing of children. Compare the non-Jewish housewife with the Jewish housewife, and you will find a more knowledgeable person. Now, I'm saying
well,
this
you're
without
talking,
any
though,
research.
About people that you know, and the people that you would come in contact with.
No,
who are
look,
not
I grew up in a small
there.
Town. I grew up in a small town, and then also in terms of my working with my clients, and also when out of the guild, with the trainees.
Yes, but you said in law school you found out that there were
I mean, I always
too.
No, but I mean, this always sort of surprised me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, yeah. We were always, you know.
The stereotypes were there. We have them as well as everybody.
And you know what? I really feel that this kind of stereotype thinking on the part of the Jew is essential, because this is the kind of thing that helps the Jew withstand a lot of the things. I mean, we have to have pride in something. And this, I mean, when you think of all of the indignities that the Jew has suffered, the cruelties and the attempts at extermination, and they've had to build up their own self-images. And if they couldn't do it in terms of me, myself, and I, at least in terms of my people, of my identification with my people, and who and what they are. And I am concerned, really, and wonder about those of the younger ones of today, and I'm not speaking generational gaps or anything.
But identity.
But identity.
Mm-hmm.
This total rejection of identity, or never having, because perhaps their parents, in the desire to be like the neighbors, never promoted. Because they themselves didn't feel this. They were placing their values on other things.
And yet, your family and mine often did take the cue from the
American, whether it was Pittsburgh or Butler, the culture around them, and
have always been very proud.
Right. To behave very
of a Jew being a Jew. Sure, you adopted the coloration and the mores, but fitted it into your framework.
Right.
You did not fit totally into the other
framework.
And this has been where the differences come in. We had Jewish identity and pride while still being part of a total community.
That's right.
And I think that this is, but anyhow, to get back to law school, it was three great years. And I entered in September, and then, about somewhere around first part of December, began the preparation for examinations. And did you see the movie Paper Chase?
Yes, indeed.
Well, our experiences were similar. And we had professors like John Howson, too.
Oh.
And here was this group.
Was it especially frightening to you as a woman, do you think, or were the young men just as petrified?
Oh, my God, there was so bad. There was this fellow, we were seated alphabetically in our section, and a big, enormous guy, Sam Solomon, sat on my left, and John Stutterford, a devout Christian, sat on my right. And when Sam Solomon would be called on, he would stand up, and the perspiration would flow from the top of his head all the way down. He would break out in such a sweat. And John Stutterford would just become tongue-tied. I don't know what I did. I guess I handled it. But anyhow, the group started forming. And one day, Milton came over to me and said, group of us are meeting this evening. Would you like to join us for this evening? Emphasis, for this evening. So we went up to his home. He lived on Darlington Road. And there were four or five others there. Men. And just taken for granted after that one evening, I guess they thought I wasn't being feminine and I wasn't being irrelevant and I was being part of it. I became part of that group from then until the time we were graduated. Was one of the boys.
Well, that must have been a really nice experience.
I was treated as one of the, at that point, you see, I was doing what Skippy Kaufman advised me to do, and not what Mort Cohen advised. I mean, you have to learn when to do and when not to do. And then it was,
about a year later.
Well,
that's what I wanted to ask.
Must have been maybe towards the end of the year, that's right. Milton, and Twig Rosenzweig went off to camp as counselors. And just before I went away, while Milton asked me to go out, and then came the fall, and they started asking me to go out more frequently, but I was very worried about it.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I was very fearful of our becoming so involved with each other, and then there being a split, and that this would spoil my role in the group.
Oh, so the woman's role did begin then to become a...
Yeah, I was concerned. I mean, that I suppose Milton and I became too involved with each other, and, you know, it would be one of these romances that broke up. What would happen to me? With whom would I be studying? You see, that part was in the back of my mind. Funny, I must tell Milton, I've never told him about that. And I hadn't thought about it in years. I'll have to tell him.
He didn't have that problem. The group of men would be there anyway.
Yeah, that's right. And I'd be the one that would be out of the group because it was his group.
Did the romance blossom quickly?
Oh, it was one of these steady growth kinds of things. It just began, you know, just going along and along, and it wasn't one of these wild romances. It was just a very stable, developing kind of relationship. Of course, Milton has very special kinds of qualities. And
he obviously saw very special qualities.
Maybe he did, I don't know. We both went out with other people up until the couple days before we were married.
Oh, real? Tell me about this. So that was another question I was going to ask. Did you have any other dates when you were in law school?
Oh, yeah. I went out with some upperclassmen. And I went out with some other people. But it was strictly a weekend deal because during the week you didn't go out. I mean, Friday and Saturday nights were the only nights that you went out. And I went out. It was an older man, I guess, you know, if someone's 4 or 5 years older than you at that stage, it was an older man. And he was the kind who would take me for dinner and the evening. With Milton, we would go. We'd sit in the second balcony of the Nixon, or we'd go on a movie and go out. Milton didn't have a car, and go out in the streetcar on that kind of thing. At one time, for me to go out in the day in the streetcar, well, just, you know, that just wasn't a thing that was done. But with Milton, I did it. And I think we had to pay for my own fee. I never had to pay for the theater. Milton always managed to scramble the dollar and a half, whatever was involved there. But when we'd go out to eat afterwards, it would depend upon how flush he was. Of course, Milton was the victim of the Depression and the banks closing. Our second year in law school, that would be in the fall of 1930, and Milton came back with, $1,200 or $1,500 he'd made as a counselor, and the fees that he got for getting campers. And he...
That was a lot of
the
money.
Bank, yeah, took the bank, and I forget the name of the bank, but the president was a man by the name of Manuel Dim. Whatever the name of the bank was. And that bank failed. And Milton and his stepfather had only the money that they had in their pockets.
Oh, so even law school became a problem.
Very much of a problem for him. Very much of a problem for him. And but through the kindness of people like Herman Passamanic, who was very, very fond of Milton, he loaned Milton money, and Milton's working and paying a tuition on installment basis. So that we had that kind of thing, but somehow or other, that whole Depression thing, although there were concerns and there were the men selling apples on the streets and the pretzels, and we were all being very careful of watching our pennies, yet, at least from my vantage point and my friends, it didn't seem to be so disastrous. I guess it's because no one had anything, and so everyone was doing without.
Yes. And you were able to continue.
And we still continued. My father, of course, had problems. He had been in the market and had borrowed money. He had bought stocks on margin, and also had borrowed money at the bank because he had been a very good businessman. And then they began calling in. And so my father's things were very, very rough. And my father had to, this was in about 31 or 32 that my father had went through bankruptcy, but paid back every penny. Not a creditor of his ever lost a penny on the thing. And he continued in business with the same creditors but with a limited with limited credit. A couple friends of Dad's and Butler were kind enough to vouch for him, although they didn't have much more than my father at that time.
Well, it wasn't
but
a matter
they that, but they but took it and so that there we managed to get along that way. And things were very rough as far. I mean, they perhaps in the store would maybe end up a day with $3 or $4 or $5.
How many of you were in school at the time? You were in law school?
I was in law school and my brother was in college. My younger sister had been graduated from high school, but she stayed home for a year because that was as much. And my brother dropped out of college. And after I finished law school, Mildred was graduated in law from high school in 32, the same time I was graduated from law school. And she stayed home for a year to give Mother and Dad a breathing spell. And then she went on to school. And my older sister, who was just simply magnificent, Sarah had trained at Michael Lee Hospital as a nurse. And her first job was with the Montefiore Hospital, the old Montefiore Hospital up on Center Avenue. They were at that time planning on moving into the present building. And Sarah was employed with the idea that she would become a supervisor of the private rooms because the hospital from which she had been graduated was one of the top ones in the country. So Sarah started working. Sarah was a supervisor of the fifth floor at the Montefiore. Do you know that she turned over every salary check to my parents?
Oh, my.
She was that kind of a person. Her feelings about it. And I provided Mildred. When Mildred started, I had been practicing law for a year. And I took care of Mildred's magnificent allowance of $5 a month and her clothes.
Oh my. It really was a very close family. Oh, felt the responsibility.
Oh, sure. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And my brother also. He was working for an auto accessory store. And Eddie lived up also got Mildred. And that's how she went through college. She was a pit for a year, but she was my sister, and they still knew me. And Mildred had to develop her own identity. Sure, it was difficult for both my brother and my sister to be siblings of mine because I was an overwhelming person.
And the teachers remembered too. It wasn't just.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was very, very difficult. And I think my parents, too, played a role in that because I was their star. And have been their star to this day. But each of us had a role in the family.
And each knew his and accepted his or her place.
And my sisters and my brother.
It's interesting that you say that. A scholar named Naomi Weinstein, an anthropologist, has written several articles about women, and the premise that she has sought to prove is that people are what other people expect them to be.
Oh, and I think that this is very true on that story, on this whole thing. And my sisters and my brother, I have the same feeling of identification and pride there has never been any jealousy. And I have led a much more dynamic a life than any of them. I've led a much more exciting life. I've gone places and done things and lived totally differently than they. And so our social life and contacts, I've always been pretty much establishment, as much as we can endure of it. But my sisters and my brothers take great pride in it. And we have not had in our family the demands that you can't have anybody unless you have your sisters and your brothers. You know, in a lot of families there is that kind of thing. We've never had that. Never had that kind of a thing. We have all had great concerns for one another, of the sharing of joys and griefs.
Yes.
But without it being inflicted upon us, of course, but we also, on the other hand, all have feelings of guilt.
That's not unusual.
About our roles with each other. And what we do or what we don't do.
Well, you started to talk about that a little bit after we finished reporting the last time.
But I mean, these are, and I guess maybe you're becoming more aware of it, or more conscious of it. Probably I've always been aware, more conscious of it now with the illness of my mother, and with our acceptance of responsibilities. None of us have pulled away from it, but my older sister has a tremendous burden because she and my mother live together, and my younger sister, who is a social worker, gives so much of herself.
But you do too.
But not at a sacrifice of what I want to do. Not as a sacrifice of my comings and goings.
Well, you appreciate them and what they're doing, but you yourself said, how often do you go? You spend a great deal of time with your mother.
Oh, I'm over there every other day for several hours.
It's giving a great deal of yourself.
Yes, but I can't and won't do what Mildred does. I won't give up evenings. If Milton and I are going somewhere, or even if we're not going, I won't go over there and stay of an evening. I won't give up Saturdays and Sundays and go over there. Mildred does. And I, as a result, have guilt about it, but I don't do a damn thing about it. Because they're nice about it. It's because
they understand perfectly.
Because they're great about it.
And they understand that
and
you,
the guilt
your
feelings
need,
are all my, that's right.
Right. They understand you're in need for this
that's
life
right.
of your own and
yep.
life with them.
Mm-hmm.
Are Mildred and Sarah married?
Sarah's a widow without children. Mildred is married. Her son has a PhD in psychology, and he's with Lee Salk's Child Development Center, and he's on the faculty of Cornell Medical School. He's married to a gal whom he met at Minnesota, where he got his PhD. She was getting her master's. He's a graduate of Carleton. And Mildred's daughter is teaching in Chicago in the inner city, and she has her master's from Bank Street School in Child Development. She had been at Cornell, and she was the one who said, I'm not going to do what the rest of the family does. I'm much person-oriented. And she went to home ec. And she ended up in child development.
Oh, that's interesting.
Because that's part of the home ec course at Cornell.
Well, there she is.
And so she became a teacher. I mean, interesting.
Person-oriented.
So, I mean, this is, I mean...
It's interesting because
girl,
the family, does,
that's right.
there is a pattern.
That's right. And my brother... who never completed school. I mean, My mother and father wanted him to be a doctor, and then they decided to settle for a dentist. And then Eddie flunked out of school. And he was this very, very, very competent, able person. So cop-outs aren't just of today.
No.
They're from a long time ago. And but Eddie has a drugstore, just retiring now, over on Buckley Street, and has done very well. His son is a hematologist, and just came back to Pittsburgh. His son had a brilliant, brilliant career, but decided that he could not take the strains of patient
clinical practice.
So he is now at the University of Pittsburgh Blood Bank program, and will be here just for a couple of years because his professor from Georgetown Medical School is setting up a program with NIH for the development of blood bank directors, but that won't be for a couple of years.
Joe
wants Joe to come with him. See, Joe had been out in Seattle. This just happened to him just this past year. He had had a history being emotionally disturbed almost from infancy. But in the face of all of his illnesses, he first had showed its evidence itself in eczema, then in asthma, and when he was five, we didn't think he was going to live. My sister-in-law took him out to Arizona, and he pulled through that. And then when he was nine, he had developed arthritis. And it was finally when they had the arthritis that Harry Margolis felt that it was this whole thing was emotionally based, and Joe started going to a child psychiatrist, to John Reinhart, a child guidance. And he was in bed more than he was up, but he was keeping up with his class and being a straight-A student all the time, being confined to bed most of the time. Then when he was 14, it evidenced itself in a stomach thing, with diarrhea, and but graduated tops in his class, one of the top students in a brilliant class at Peabody. I mean, every one of them, his class, achieved tremendously. He went on to Penn State, and finally they sent him home, started a fit, and he really cracked up, and he came here the next week was out, he came here to live for a year. Then went on and graduated Phi Beta Kappa from Pitt. After he was here, he went to work, lived at Chancellor Litchfield's home. You know how they had the students?
Right. Uh-huh.
And then he was accepted to Georgetown Medical School. Then went on to Case Western Reserve Hospital, interned there in residence. Mm-hmm.
Think about that. That's a remarkable
accomplishment. And then it was when he was in medical school that he decided that he was interested in hematology. And then went on to Berkeley, was out there for 2 years, still in blood coagulation. And then went up to Washington, which is supposed to be the best in hematology. And it was there, I guess, we don't know whether it was a combination of the weather, or with Nixon having changed the whole pattern of of research. Everything was going into cancer. And Joe just could not endure working with children who were dying.
Oh, well, terrible pressures for a young man.
But he withstood all those pressures.
Oh, and he'll make a great career in another thing.
No question about it. But that's the
fantastic family. Now everyone really has accomplished in his or her own way.
And then my son, the rabbi.
Beautiful. Let's go back to your romance with Milton and the last years of law school.
So my parents fell in love with Milton the minute they saw him.
Oh, really? When did they meet him?
I started law school in September 29. They must have met Milton in the spring of 1930, because you know, the whole gang came up to Butler.
Oh, and they nodded with approval.
They liked Milton, and Milton started coming up to Butler quite frequently, and they just adored him. And there were a couple other men that came around, the men who had some money. Milton laughs at the pieces about one of them, Eddie Hirschberg, from McKeesport.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And my parents didn't want him to know how. And this is typical of my parents, even though they knew that there would be a great deal of financial security and all of that, and that Milton didn't have a penny.
Was Eddie a professional also?